DFPC
hearings in Los Angeles, did they shake up the Boilermakers Union or...
At that time...
Or the employers?
I think that it shook up the employers more than it did the unions. Lots of the unions die hard in the steel trades. Iron workers, boilermakers, glass cutters, and even up until now. it's still a problem. But during that time, and serving on the vice president, it was just something that wasn't cracking. And some of the leadership of the FFL was far doing more than was done. And we think Bill Bassett, which was Secretary of Treasury, that he did a lot toward trying to help it, but he only was so far because the building trade was very strong.
Okay. Were you familiar with some of the groups in the community, like the Negro Victory Committee, and could you just describe?
No, I'm not. Lots of them came up, and lots of them was not recognized as far as the black community concerned as a viable organization.
How do you think that the sentiment was in the community during the war as far as why are we being asked to fight this war when we're not getting our fair share here? How did they react to that?
I would say that I have never heard anybody in my time that indicated not to be patriotic. Mm-hmm. This is their country, and the only one they knew that they wanted to protect. Mm-hmm. That was the most I've never. Now, I've heard some people off the cuff say that we don't have a right to be fighting in the war, what the hell are we going to get out of it, or something like that. But for it overall, I think that the sentiment was fighting a particular country.
So you think that it was more a question of having an equal opportunity to do that? That was the attitude that the community took, was we want the same chance to defend the country as anybody else?
Yes, but we didn't want a segregated army. Mm-hmm. That was the biggest cry that I heard of in the community. Of the segregated army, and when President Truman, when he eliminated that was accepted very graciously. But far as not wanting to go fight because we weren't getting our share, the sentiment wasn't strong.
I was just wondering what type of tactics the UAW depended on when they would go in to organize a shop in this period. How would they approach the workforce?
Well, what they would do, they would go into the shop and find somebody who was interested in the union. And then they would build an implant committee. And that implant committee and the organizers would meet and set up strategy with the implant committee and then keep adding on to that committee until you get enough cards signed. And then a petition put up. But, for instance, if you got a shop where you say you have 1,000 black, 3,000 Spanish, 5,000 white, you would try to have a nucleus of those people and let them start working on those people and then get them out to meetings at night and talk, and then they would in turn go in the shop and talk to fellows and then keep them going until they had enough had enough vote, had enough card signed to petition NLRB. That's how they did it.
Didn't the UAW do a lot of educational work among the workforce, you know, saying that, you know, brotherhood is necessary to have a strong union?
Yes, they had we had education committees. We have summer schools. We would invite organizing committees to the summer schools and see how they operated. We had summer schools throughout the whole United States, and never just like you would have one here. We'd go up to Hot Springs, California, and we would bring in people who was on the organizing committee, see the union in operation. It would be all races. It's a brother. It was really great. With all its faults, it was a great organization.
They also turned out literature on the subject too, didn't they?
Yes, had all kinds of materials, educational materials, pamphlets. They'd write some, send the communications home to the houses, and then also to the community. The UAW doesn't stop, or didn't stop then, at only organizing. They would work after, a year around. During the 40s, it wasn't, you can take this example, for instance, and break it down, because it's much more now than it was in the 40s. So we have an education director in every region, and we got an education committee in every shop. And that's a value. Lots of unions fail to educate their people. But that's one of the big musts of the union, of our union.
You remember, could you describe what some of this literature would say? Like, how would you approach a person who just come into Southern California from Oklahoma or Arkansas or, you know, someplace in the deep south and convince them that this man was his brother?
Well, the basic thing that you start to working on a person to join the union is what benefits. How much do, what does it mean to me at benefit? That's the number one.
Okay.
I mean, the brotherhood is secondary. You see, and they will go, they got charts and things drawn up on what it costs to belong to the union and how much benefits you get out of it. See, that's the overriding thing. If you go to try to sell the union, join the union because it's a black or brown or something over there, you've lost out to start with. They come in as a matter of, this is a right that we've got people working together. But that isn't an issue that you try at the first time to sell people. You don't even try to sell out the blacks.
Right.
The only thing you sell the blacks is that they got the same rights as anybody else, a Mexican or minority. And one of the basic things is that to sell to people is that you've got seniority. That you can't be fired just because the boss doesn't like you. Or get up on the wrong side of the bed. You got insurance. You got vacations. And other benefits. See, that's what you sell to people now. Incidental, I mean, that's like some people, you wouldn't even mention the racist at all. Oh, that's his ass.
So it never was a big issue, then?
Yes, it always has been an issue with blacks. More than it has been. I don't think that the issue with even the Southerners coming into this, that the black issue was the overriding issue. I think that what the benefits that they were getting out of it, they would say, well, I can endure the other. For instance, the first time when I went into the plant, the Ku Klux met. and Charlie Carmen, the last fellow, met with them and told them what to pay. Those people got to have jobs. They work like anybody else. So he was had the will to approach him and so that erased the issue for that time. Then after I was in there, and within 5 years, those same people became my supporters.
So it was just kind of a gradual thing that grew on?
Yeah, number one, so many people's background have taught different things that they had never had the opportunity to experience. And they look at things in a different way than what they really are until they know it. The economic cost in our society today, and school busing, for instance, and that, those things, they make a big deal out of it. When I've been school busing, I've been busing kids ever since I was a kid. And in the South, the housing, they made a big deal out of housing. And I came from Oklahoma, and my next door neighbor was white. It's no big deal in Oklahoma at all, where I came from, about housing. A friend of mine lived across from the banker. See, so it's the stereotype thing that taught to people, and they don't get a chance to experience in themselves. I guess, I don't know what state you're from, what your background might be, but the people, I feel sorry for lots of the people in the youngsters in the South and the past on how they were taught. They're missing something in their whole lives because of how they've been reared.
Yeah. I was just wondering if, you know, there was any special, you know, approach that was used once the worker was in the local, how you did handle that appeal. You know.
Well, what you do, once you get into get people organized, then you build a program based upon strength. You know, you build, just like you, in this shop, you have different committees, and among you have fair practice, education, women's committee, and different ones like that. And then you have your conventions, and they get to mixing with each other. And then you go to having your picnics. You work it in psychological, you know. You don't force it in.
Right.
You work it in gradually. And people get to know each other, and it's much different. They get to go in, they get to work beside each other and get to go into each other's homes. And then you have materials on fair practices that they're exposed to. You have your monthly paper they're exposed to, where you're talking about these issues. Then you have different leaders that come out and meet the local union and talk about the value of solidarity. And then they go back into history and bring up some, we have all kinds of visual education that you show these films of how things were in the past and what it did to take, split the worker. And how that the big business has pitted one worker against the other. We have all those kind of things that you show and let people absorb it. You don't force anything unless it's a person's rights. Now, if a person, that's like we got a bargaining committee, if he doesn't pick up a person's grievance because this could be prejudice or something, he doesn't like you, we've got a recourse to take it on to another step. So it's brought on in that manner in our union.
How did the riots in Detroit during the war affect people out here? You know, what did they think about it?
Well, we had one here first.
Oh, that's right, the Zoot Suit Riot?
No, we had the big riot here. We had a riot here before the Detroit riot. The Watts and all that was burned down. All up and all out.
No, I'm talking about during the Second World War. Is that your, are you talking about?
Yeah, the Second World War.
Oh, there was one in Los Angeles?
Yeah. The Second World War. Mm-hmm.
Could you just, what was involved in that?
Oh, man, that was, the whole city was on fire. That was before the Detroit riot. What happened is it started, let me see, what year you said? In 42?
Well, yeah, 42, I think, was Detroit, yeah. Or 43.
Well, I don't remember a riot being in Detroit. Now, I remember a riot being in Detroit in the 50s.
Now, during the war, there was a very... pretty famous riot because it was very embarrassing to the United States. It got picked up in the international news, and the Nazis used it as propaganda against the United States. You know, they said, "How can the United States say they're fighting for freedom when this is happening to?"
Well, I don't remember a riot, and I remember the riot, the two. I remember the riot in Detroit, the last riot.
In 67?
Yeah. Well, I don't remember the riot in 42.
I don't remember. Well, then I guess it didn't have much of a...
No, I don't remember the riot in 42. Yeah. Oh, that was the beginning of me starting in the labor movement. Yeah. And maybe I was young and going too fast, so I didn't pay attention to it out here. Yeah. But I didn't... And 42 is just when I began to get involved. So I never did remember... I didn't remember a riot of any consequences that had any effect upon... the people out here, I mean, to any great extent. At least, I was, not me, you know, I don't know.
Okay. At the end of the war, there was an economic decline. Mm-hmm. And how did that affect some of the gains that were made during the war for the black community?
Got laid off. the last one hired.
First fired,
and they got laid off. It became a big problem, and one of them, some of the things that affect the black community is when they hired women to take over the responsibility for the necessity of the war. And then when the war was ended, there was lots of men were laid off and the women still had their jobs. Even that had effect on even the black women staying on the jobs and the black men out of the jobs. So it had a double effect. For instance, if you went to the war and most of the aircraft plants had more women at that time to hold than men. So when the guys from the army came back, they couldn't go in and buck those women off the job. So it had a kind of a double effect on them. And what jobs were available to them, lots of them didn't have skills. They did, lots of them were a little school. But it didn't do any good for our society as it relates to the black progress. It had a direct effect on it.
Oh, the setback for the black community.
Mm-hmm. Not for the black people. Did you say union or?
No, community. Yeah.
Community, yes, right. It did. And still, if you take a look, if you look at it, you can see I can notice this, and I've been quite concerned that you see the women, which have always, this is what the majority of race have always wanted, keep the black man down and let the woman go ahead. And that is more prominent now if you look at the people that's given power. You can see women getting appointed much faster on the ratio than the men. You take, for instance, in the state legislature, we have, let's see, 3 men and I think 4 or 5 women. State legislature. I mean, those are things that helped to build this woman in the war, and after the war, she kept going on. And the soldiers and the people that came back was held at a standstill because they had to go out and seek jobs and seek training and go to school.
How did the people who were laying off, who were being laid off, deal with seniority questions? Did they feel that they were being unfairly treated by seniority rule?
What happens in the Supreme Court rule, the only way they felt like they were being discriminated is when they went to get these jobs and they were turned down. And which this was something that the unions fought against, the Supreme Court rule that anybody who had sought a job and it was turned down was entitled to be placed in plant and over the person of that seniority, which the unions fought against it, but the Supreme Court ruled against it. Now, we have a deep feeling that as blacks, that we have been handicapped. But most union people that where seniority is involved, I don't think feel badly when they're laid off accordingly.
Okay.
I don't feel like that they look back into 50 years ago and say, well, you know, these guys have had this opportunity. They've been working here for 30 years and I just come in 20 years. Well, if they lay off everybody from the 20 years, according to seniority, I don't think there's too many have objections to that. Which we realize that this is happening all over the country right now in every walks of life. It's a problem that America got.
So there wasn't any demand for preferential layoffs or changing the seniority system at the end of the war?
Not in no great deal. I have heard just very little about a preference. See, for years we fought the quota system. Blacks fought the quota system for years. Which in the later years we have kind of eased in on the quota system, you know. But during that time, in the 40s, we fought the quota system. Because we felt like that we were surprised so long that we should be given an opportunity to work regardless of what we were black.
So you felt the quota system was working against you back then?
Yes.
Okay. You mentioned the Supreme Court decision that said that seniority had to be modified to make allowances for these people who had applied for jobs earlier and been denied. Which decision was that you were referring to?
Well, within the last 3 years that decision was made, and if you could prove that you have been denied a job, say 5 years ago, you would get a job in that plant according to company. If you could prove that the company would be penalized and you'd have to go back in the shop, well, that's where the company didn't fight it as hard as the union, because the union was caught in a bind Here you have seniority. Didn't have anything to do with this fellow, with this company not hiring this guy. And then they come and place a person over you. See, the union was in a pretty embarrassing position to say, well, you have seniority, but you're going to lose it. But that's the Supreme Court handed them down within the last 2 or 3 years. And some cases have won.
Do you remember some of the civil rights cases in employment, like James versus Marine Ship and the Boilermakers and the Steel versus Louisville Railroad? They were all in the mid-40s, right around the end of the war. And did they have any big effects on the rights of black workers trying to protect their jobs during the layoffs? Or?
Well, in my union, it did. Because in my union, those rights were pretty well protected. The UAW was pretty well protected. I would say myself that as a union or as a group of people, the rights of individuals, whether women, black or white, is pretty well protected in 90% of our union. Okay. And so therefore, Walter Luther was a guy that laid the foundation. And I'm kind of proud to see, to be a member of the UAW, and to have been experienced enough to go around to all of the shops, because in my job I went around to every shop. And I watched very closely how they operate. And if you don't get justice, you got a recourse, and therefore 90%, even in the South, is pretty well protected. So therefore, those cases really a lot of the unions structure is so fouled up that you have and you have bureaucracies and unions just like you have anything else. But when it's turned over to the people, where they have some control over their own destiny, then you have a chance to get justice much easier than you can where you got to have. To go to somebody else who is not in the same position you are, making the decision.
One of the things that I've heard about at the end of the war was that the UAW leadership and Walter Reuther had some proposals for changing the war plants over to peacetime production, some proposals to save the jobs so that these workers wouldn't have to be laid off. Do you remember those?
Yeah. They tried to get them to go into the housing, making it prefab housing, and encourage them to they worked on that here. Paul Strade, I don't know whether you know him or not, he's a young man out of North America. He wasn't able to sell it to the company. Same thing. After the war, we started, even after the war, trying to sell little cars to them. Because they had looked at the future, and they wanted to try to protect the people that had the possibility of being laid off, and they couldn't.
Okay, the one other question I had was about the effect of Taft-Hartley on the unions, and did they begin to depend more on the black community for support after Taft-Hartley, or did that harden some of the positions of the unions and make them more insensitive? How do you think that affected them?
Well, I don't During this half-hearted fight, the union fought against it, saying that the boys leading it, there was a black guy named Bill Abner. I made a dynamic speech telling, asking them that they should support it. And it passed anyway. Really, I don't see where it hurt. I think that the half part of all, I think the unions brought those things on themselves. My name is Griffin. I think the unions brought those things on themselves. And I don't think it really had a great impact upon the membership or as a whole. I don't see where it hurt anything.
Okay, so... Well, I heard some people claim that it gave, at least in the area of civil rights, it gave some of the black members a little more clout because the closed shop couldn't be used against them to exclude them from employment. That they wanted a job. That it didn't matter what the union thought, they had to take them in.
Well, we don't have, we never did have closed shops. Anyway,